Okay, so let me turn to a different topic, and it's a different sort of conflict. Jared Kushner is some parts of his book. He's releasing a book. I look at it on Amazon now. It says it's going to be released on August 23rd in a couple of weeks, called "Breaking History: A White House Memoir." There are a couple allegations he makes that have caused some news. I'd like you to address it, please. One, that then Prime Minister Netanyahu surprised President Trump in the White House in announcing about annexation. And then he put out a statement, which is unusual, that his office put out a statement that I'll quote. The allegation that Prime Minister Netanyahu surprised Jared Kushner and President Trump by announcing Israel's intention to apply Israeli law to the 30% of Judea and Samaria envisioned in the Trump plan as sovereign Israeli territory is completely false, a spokesperson for Netanyahu said on Thursday. A second allegation, and I know you have a lot more you could add flesh to that. The second allegation was that Prime Minister Netanyahu came off a bit nonplussed when he was informed by the White House that President Trump was going to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Suggested, I think, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but something effective. Well, if you do, if you make such an announcement, I'll support it. And Kushner, I think, writes like, he was rather surprised he didn't get a more enthusiastic response. What's your, you were in the thick of this. What's your thoughts about that, the Kushner book?
So first, let me deal with the allegation regarding Jerusalem, and I'll get to the specific comment. I haven't read, I have to say, I haven't read Jared's book yet. I got an early draft. I've just hadn't had a chance to look at it, and I'm a little bit wary of responding to press reports about what he said rather than looking specifically at what he said and what context he put it in. But I'll say overall first before the specific thing with this call, this apparent phone call between Trump and Netanyahu. I mean, there was a phone call and I was on that call. But before I get to that, just understand Israel's position in Jerusalem throughout was that we were supportive of that throughout. It was raised, I wouldn't say it was the highest priority item for Israel at any point, because we were really focused on Iran above everything else. What happened was Trump during the election campaign said that he was going to move the embassy, said that, and recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And previous American presidents, particularly George W. Bush, because Obama didn't say it, but George W. Bush said that he was going to do it and ended up not doing it. So when Trump said it in his campaign, you know, okay, so he said it in the campaign. The question is he going to do it? And when I met with people in Trump's team during the transition, then I realized that he actually was serious about doing it, or that's what it seemed at the time. And we were very supportive of that action. And there was an idea in the Trump administration for him to do it as his first act as president, actually. Meaning to come back from the inauguration and then go to the White House and then to just make that signature, to sign it and to authorize it. Of course, that did not happen. But we were very supportive. I publicly talked about this during the transition in order to kill the suggestion that Israel was not supportive, because people use that to fight against Trump's decision. Because they said, hey, even the Israelis don't want it. And so you can just Google it and you'll see that I said, well, Israel hopes that next year the new American ambassador to Israel will light a menorah in his embassy in Jerusalem, you know, where the city where the Maccabees lit it 2,200 years ago. So I was saying that publicly. This is December 2016. And I briefed the senior members of the Trump administration about our policy on Jerusalem and encouraged them at the instruction of Netanyahu, who told me focus on that. Because once I told them that they were serious and this was a real possibility, he told me we'll make it a priority because we want to get this over the finish line. And so I did. And in several meetings with all the people in the Trump team, we made clear to them how much we supported this decision. Then you remember the way that the Jerusalem decision went down is that every 6 months, presidents would kick the can down the road, because the original legislation that was passed in 1995 in the Jerusalem Embassy Act enabled the president, for reasons of national security, to delay the decision every 6 months. So the first time that that President Trump had to make a decision was actually only in May of his first year as president, the end of May, beginning of June. That was when the waiver came about, because Obama had issued the waiver, final waiver, in December, the previous December, and he would only face a decision in May and June. He didn't do it on his first day in office. So the next time there was really a decision point was May and June. And when Prime Minister came in February to Washington, this is February 2017, and when Trump came in May 2017 to Israel, both times the prime minister said that he was supportive. And when the decision came down in May and June, Trump decided to delay that decision. And there were a lot of people who were upset about it. And a lot of people thought, listen, it's all talk, no action. And he delayed that decision to December. So now we're moving almost a full year into Trump's presidency. And the issue that Jared is probably raising, not having read how exactly he put it, was a phone call that happened in December. And the issue of the phone call was very specific, and it had to do with intelligence regarding this decision. Meaning, the way that many people were fighting within the administration against Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem and move the embassy was to make an argument that it was going to cause, you know, World War III. That was going to cause attacks against U.S. Embassies throughout the region and facilities, and it's going to lead to violence. And this was what was used in the past.
I think Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, they opposed it, right?
I mean, yes. So, yeah, Mattis did, as you said. Tillerson did. McMaster did. Pompeo is interesting because he said, my organization opposes it. I personally support it. But the ones who were supportive of it were...
He was head of the CIA then.
Head of the CIA, exactly. Were Nikki Haley, who was the UN ambassador at the time. Vice President Pence was a big advocate for it. And David Friedman, who was really ended up becoming the person to make the case for Jerusalem in a dramatic meeting in the Situation Room that really pitted all the people who were for it and all the people who were against it against each other. It was a little bit like what happened in May of 1948, May 12th, I believe, 1948, when you had, under Truman, you had Clark Clifford make the case for the recognition of Israel against George Marshall, the Secretary of State at the time, who was arguing against it. So here you had in the White House Situation Room, it was, I think it was the end of November when that meeting happened, the very end of November. And David was able to, I think, make the arguments and win the case, and the president went with him. But before that meeting broke up, and this is what I knew at the time as well, and I think David's account is very accurate, his account in his book Sledgehammer, is that the people who were opposed to it in the national security establishment of the United States asked to speak to their Israeli counterparts to make sure that Israel was supportive of it, meaning they were trying to use the Israeli security establishment to undermine President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital. So I can tell you that when I found out about that, you know, I informed Prime Minister Netanyahu. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, you go back and read the news at the time, I called him up immediately because I knew this decision was going to happen. And I want him to be aware, hey, they're going to call the military chief of staff, the head of military intelligence, the director of the Mossad, the Shin Bet. Netanyahu decided, when I called him, I thought I was going to have to wake him up because the calls were going to come the next day. I wanted the prime minister to be aware of it. What we knew, just to set this up, what we knew at the time, our intel was not showing that it was going to lead to any explosion. And the prime minister's position was, that's what our intel shows. And even if there would be a problem, I would still support it because it's important enough for Israel I will take responsibility for that. But I don't know what the heads of the security establishment are going to say, You know, there's a lot of ways that you can present intel to people, and you could, you know, you could present it in a certain light or present it in a different light. I don't know. But anyway, I called Prime Minister Netanyahu. I thought I was going to wake him up. He was actually on the tarmac about to take off from Ben Gurion Airport to go on a trip to Africa. And I told him the story and we discussed it. And he says, he instructed the National Security Advisor of Israel, Meir Ben Shabbat, who we affectionately call RMBS. He told him to get off the plane and go speak to the head of the security services and make it clear to them that they better present the intelligence just as it is, not to game in a different way, because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get the recognition for Jerusalem. And Meir Ben Shabbat, who's the National Security Advisor of Israel and who planned the whole trip of the Prime Minister to Africa, actually got off the plane to go speak to the heads of the security establishment. So if anyone is going to suggest that Netanyahu did not want this decision to come through, it is an absurdity. Now, what happens in the exact phone call? In the phone call, the president can say to the prime minister, you know, there's a lot of people who say it's going to be World War III. What do you think? And the prime minister is giving a very cold assessment of the intelligence. We do not see it that it's a problem. I want you to know that if there is a problem, I take responsibility for it. I support your decision to do it. So Netanyahu is speaking as the head, the person on top of the, let's say, the security pyramid in Israel, to make it clear to the president. But it was very much a business-like conversation. And I think Trump thought in that particular conversation, even though he'd heard from Netanyahu for a year, and everybody in Trump's team heard from me for a year already, how much we support this decision, that it wasn't fulsome enough in the praise. And if I remember correctly, when word got back to Netanyahu that he wasn't, you know, clear enough in how much he supported this decision, he actually instructed me to tell them again, and I think he did another phone call telling him how big a decision it is. But the reason why I think there's this confusion is that the discussion with Trump in that specific phone call dealt with intel and what the intelligence showed rather than a political discussion over whether this was a good thing or not. Netanyahu, I know this is a lot of information to download on a podcast, and this is why you have to write a book to lay it all out. But Netanyahu from beginning to end was supportive of that decision. And I acted all the time within Washington to advance that decision. But a lot of the people in the Trump administration who really was the one of all the people in the Trump administration besides President Trump who really deserves the credit because he made the decision, which was a big decision against the opinion of his entire national security team. The person in the Trump administration who deserves the most credit is David Friedman, is the ambassador of Israel who really navigated that and shepherded it over the finish line.
Okay. Well, that's a full-throated refutation of that allegation. Very informative. What about the other allegation about the Prime Minister Netanyahu surprise President Trump on the issue of annexation?
Well, if Trump was surprised, he shouldn't have been surprised because he should have been informed of what he was signing. Because what Netanyahu revealed for the first time, actually, which is interesting how little press coverage it got, was that there was an exchange of letters between him and President Trump on the eve of the launch of the peace plan. And so in those letters, it is clear that the U.S. is going to back Israel's move to apply its laws to the territory that the Trump plan designated as part of Israel in the future, which is 30% of the territory of Judea and Samaria. And Israel, in exchange, would embrace the Trump peace plan, which ultimately called for a two-state solution, and also comport its policies so that the territory that would be designated for a future Palestinian state would basically be left untouched for a minimum of 4 years. And it was also clear in Netanyahu's response to President Trump that he was going to move forward with this decision within days. in the coming days. That's what it says in the letter. So it's very clear. So Jared knows that letter, and he read both of those letters, clearly. So why he would think anything else, you'd have to ask him. I don't know. Whether Trump was fully informed by his team, I don't know, but Trump signed the letter, and that was the basis for Netanyahu to come to Washington. Netanyahu came to Washington with a promise that was backed by a presidential commitment in hand, that he wasn't just coming to embrace a plan and to also embrace a map. Now, Netanyahu is the leader of the Likud party. It's not like the leader of Meretz or the leader of the Labor Party or even Lapid's party, who every Monday and Thursday can embrace a plan that ultimately calls for a two-state solution. This is Netanyahu, the head of the Likud, that comes and takes a huge political risk in coming and embracing this plan. Now, I think that plan was very good for Israel. But a lot of people, as you remember, on the right did not, because they were opposed ideologically under any circumstances. I think that the plan that President Trump and his team, including obviously Jared Kushner being foremost among them, Jason Greenblatt, Avi Berkowitz, others, that plan, and David Friedman, of course, that plan is as good a plan as Israel's ever going to get in the international community. And I think it's a great plan. But Netanyahu was coming to Washington in the middle of an election campaign. And he took a huge political risk to do so. And the way that the what got him to the dance, so to speak, was a clear commitment that he was going to walk away with something. Yes, he was going to take this risk. Yes, he was going to move the Likud into supporting this plan, but they were going to get something tangible in return. So that Jared was surprised is a surprise to me. It means that he did not clearly read the two letters. And whether or not the president was surprised, it would mean that his team did not fully brief the president on what was at stake. But I can assure you that without those letters, Netanyahu does not come to Washington, 100%. And that those letters, which were not revealed, and there was a lot of confusion over annexation and non-annexation, annexation, quote-unquote annexation, we don't use the term annexation because we feel that these territories in Judea and Samaria...
Extending sovereignty,
right. But that's not part of the peace plan. It's not connected to the peace plan. And it is not, it is doesn't contradict the peace plan, the commitment, and is actually done in parallel to the peace plan. But I think I read something that Jared had written that he told David Friedman that he showed the peace plan to David. And he said to David, where is this extension of sovereignty in the peace plan? It's not here. That's not how I remember it. What I think he showed David was the letters. And he said, where is it here? And I think David told Jared, I'm a good lawyer. You know, and I take a lot of cases, and I'm telling you, this is an easy case to make, that the commitment to Israel and to the prime minister is in black and white, and it is in black and white. And so I don't know why Jared has not mentioned those letters, but they were there. They were the basis of the prime minister making the decision. Look, at the end of the day...
one thing, just to clarify again, these are letters... from the president to the prime minister, just to clarify exactly.
Yes, a letter addressed from President Trump to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the counter letter between Prime Minister Netanyahu to President Trump.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And it was done on the eve. I mean, I physically brought one letter to Jared. Jared physically brought a letter to the prime minister back signed by the president. And he did it the night before. So he's aware of that. That doesn't mean that he was supportive of it. That doesn't mean he was a great fan of it. But that's what the commitment of the United States was at the time to the prime minister. So when Prime Minister of Israel, who is very detailed oriented, as you know, who knows every single comma that is put into every single letter.
And footnote.
He went and he told the people of Israel that there was going to be a declaration of sovereignty. And he told the Israeli press that in the coming days, we're going to do this. Why did he say that? It's because he had this exchange of letters and a commitment from the administration. And afterwards, the administration backtracked on it. And that led to a kind of, it moved into this mapping committee, and it took some time. And then there was going to be a partial move, which we don't have to get into right now. And it was right before the partial move was going to happen that the Emiratis came to the administration and said, look, we're willing to normalize with Israel. And that changed the whole dynamic and ultimately led to the Abraham Accords. What I will tell you is another thing that is false, and maybe we'll speak about it on another podcast. It is true that people hung their hat on the suspension of the annexation as moving ahead with normalization. But had Israel gone ahead right away in the end of January 2020, and had Israel applied its laws and extended its sovereignty to the territories that the Trump map outlined as being part of Israel, I have no doubt that we would eventually have normalized several months later with those Arab states. Anyway, despite that, because it would have been in our rearview mirror, we would have made the decision. And the decision, mind you, is not just, okay, and this is where some people on the right in Israel didn't support. The decision is not only to say, well, this 30% of territory, which is the large settlement blocks, the Jordan Valley, and then smaller isolated settlements, the decision is not only that 30%, Israel has to do something else as well. It has to embrace the Trump plan, which ultimately calls for a two-state solution, leave territory designated for a Palestinian state, don't touch it for the next 4 years, and also comport your building policy to only build in those areas which will be the areas that you've extended sovereignty to. So that was all part of a package deal. And I believe had Israel gone ahead and done it with the backing of the United States, I have no doubt that we would have normalized, not the same day, not the same week, maybe not the same month, but I have no doubt that we would have been able to do it several months later, because the interests, as we've discussed on this podcast, the interests of the Arab states are to normalize with Israel because of their security interests and their economic interests. But unfortunately, the administration did not back the move for sovereignty. And what is interesting, one last point, I remember during this period, the criticism on the right of Netanyahu, that Netanyahu is the one that's holding up the sovereignty, that Trump wants to do it, that everything was ready, and Netanyahu is the one who held it up. And now, as all the information begins to come out, and we've just hit the tip of the iceberg of that information, it's completely not the case. Just as was true in Jerusalem, where Netanyahu from beginning to end was supportive of it, the same is true of sovereignty. From beginning to end, Netanyahu was supportive of it. But to actually apply Israeli law to these territories without the support of the United States, that you can do anytime. You'll do it in a clash with the United States. You'll probably face the consequences of the UN Security Council because of that clash. But you can do that at any time. The unique thing was that we had obtained a commitment from the United States to recognize Israel's move. And that made it completely different. And that's the reason why the prime minister was willing to embrace this plan. In the end, the plan did not move forward, unfortunately. Sovereignty did not move forward, unfortunately. But the Abraham Accords did, which I think is a great boon for the region. And that, I must say, Jared Kushner, I mentioned before, the person in the administration who gets the most credit for Jerusalem, besides Trump, was David Friedman. The person in the Trump administration who deserves the most credit for the Abraham Accords, and maybe we'll speak about this in some other episode, is Jared Kushner, for sure. And so on that, I think he did a fantastic job working these relationships and translating the tremendous trust that he had achieved with leaders in the region to help achieve this historic peace between Israel and the Emirates that then led to four peace agreements. But after I finish reading the entire book, I guess then we can go back and we can discuss it more specifically.